Because she had always been on time. The foreman never so much as flinched at his forearm when she had to leave early. She's good labor. Not even a baby can make her late. 90 minutes later, I was born a month early. The lieutenant and my dad was proud that I was on time. Military time. For the last time. Growing up, I was always told time is not a suggestion, it's a fact. Non-negotiable, so I guess that's why I'm anti-punctual, because clocks make me feel like a hostage with the way that they're armed. Skin-flavored nightmares every day of me at half past black, public enemy number one, neck dangling from an oversized clock. This is the face of chronometrophobia. I am on CP time, New Mexican and Indian time, and frankly, it's sad that that's still not enough time. I can barely keep up time, and it's so sad I still need more. The leash given me by God, family, and friends alone. Never by appointment nor employer, except for the time when I was 415 Hakeem on my name tag and schedule at Eddie Bauer. But I was proud when their manager proposal began with, "He may not come when you want him, but he always shows up." I'm not the type to call out. I'm the type that's running behind. Chasing my dreams has me late for their reality. Chasing my future has me late for their now. So just know when I show up a hair less dressed and stressed, it's simply because I haven't met my future yet. And when they say dumb shit like, "If you would have just left 10 minutes earlier, all the lights would have been green," I know exactly what they mean. But when they say dumb shit like, "If you would have left 10 minutes earlier, he's the type that would be late to his own funeral," I have no fucking idea what that means. Of course I want to be late to my own funeral. In fact, I'll be a no-show if I have any say in the matter. So what if I am too much heart hemmed up to a surplus of sleeve, never cufflinked to but covering my forearm foreman because I never know what time to leave? Plus, I already told you about my phobia of clocks. They just remind me that we're all running out of time, and I'm sorry I borrow a couple of your seconds to enjoy the ride. I'm sorry I try to love everybody at the same time, and I didn't prioritize your deadline over my lifeline. I mean no disrespect, and I don't mean to take your time, but I mean to take mine. When I'm late, I hear me ticking, knowing that when I leave, I would not have spent as much time with you as I would have liked. Just like the conversation I haven't seen in forever at the market, the "No, mom, this is not a bad time" on the phone, the "Yes, son, I have time for one more video game," the third snooze, the cuddle for breakfast, the best part of waking up is laying next to me in bed, the 5 more minutes won't hurt that made me late to this. Hi, I'm now 15 Hakeem. Pleased to meet you. And I'm sorry I'm not embarrassed or ashamed. In fact, I feel relieved, even though there certainly wasn't enough time to stop for bathroom or gas. I just drive 85 miles per hour from wherever I was to be in your presence. And I wish you were all arms and unconditional instead of frowns and perfection, because I am not God. But just like them folk in that old black church say about their God, he may not come when you want him, but he's on time.
And that was Hakeem Bellamy, Albuquerque's poet laureate, reading Chronometrophobia. I was a little nervous, to be honest, to pronounce that word, but I think I did okay. I was so lucky to be at an event where I got to hear this incredible musician, adventurer, poet, writer. Hakeem pretty much does it all. On his website, beyondpoetryinc.com, under the About section, Hakeem says, and I quote, "As the inaugural Poet Laureate of Albuquerque, New Mexico, Hakeem Bellamy is a national and regional Poetry Slam champion and holds 3 consecutive collegiate Poetry Slam titles at the University of New Mexico. Hakeem has been published in multiple places. He's also been named Best Poet in the Weekly Alibi's annual Best of Berkey poll every year since 2010. His first book, Swear, won the Tilly Olson Award for Creative Writing from the Working Class Studies Association. Hakeem has done so much, and now he's in law school as well. I just couldn't wrap my head around everything that this human being is involved in. And not only that, he's going to law school so that he can change legislation both here in the state of New Mexico and I suspect someday nationally. He is a fierce social justice warrior and he uses everything, his words, his art, his creative spirit, pretty much his entire being, he's using to make this world a better place for other people. I was just so excited that he said yes when I asked him for an interview. So now, without further ado, my interview with Hakeem Bellamy, Poet Laureate of Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Fast forward, now I'm at the hospital. My mom gets the call and I'm at the hospital. Before my mom arrives to the hospital, the triage nurse sets me up in the room now. They put something on the bleeding and they're kind of asking me questions before the police get there to take a formal, like get my statement. And she's leaving the room, a middle-aged white woman, and she turns around, her back, she's walking out. Her back stiffens up and she turns around and her eyes are different and her voice is different. She walks back over to my bed and she looks at me and says, "You weren't supposed to go tonight. God has a plan for you." How do I self-describe in a way that is way much too long? That's probably how I would self-describe. But if I can distill it down to its essence, I use words to build community. And that can present itself in many different ways. In fact, my LLC, Beyond Poetry LLC, our kind of raison d'etre mission statement is building community one word at a time. Language can definitely be a divisive thing. Words, as we've seen in the kind of current era of banning books, can be a way to push people apart, or they can be used to bring people together. And all I've ever really known with the great orators in the Black oratorical tradition, the Malcolm X's and the Martin Luther King's of the world, the entertainers, we just lost a Tina Turner or a Mahalia Jackson or a Marian Anderson, the talents I've seen my people be given are ways to create a crowd, to bring people together. And I think as a spoken word artist in the spoken word tradition, That's what I do. I use language to try to get people on the same page, even though I'm using language to criticize and comment on the world around me, oftentimes in very critical ways, just to be able to have a conversation is a gathering of sorts. And that's what I like to think I do. Now, the longer version is like, and that's allowed me to work in policy, and that's allowed me to work in philanthropy, and that's allowed me to work in city and state government. But at the heart of it all, I don't get invited to any of those spaces if it's not for my experience as a poet and as an artist.
And of course, I have had the thrilling experience of seeing you perform in person, and it was just hypnotic, if I can be honest. It was so exciting. I mean, the space was beautiful, and you were framed by this gorgeous plant wall, but you and your, I guess, cohort in crime were just absolutely enthralling.
Oh, thank you. Shout out to Stuart Smith. In fact, we got to share space with Stuart on his last week in New Mexico before moving back to his home state of Michigan. But so it was cool to celebrate that with him because we made music in this community, made art in this community for a long time. And hadn't in the last 3 or 4 years, pandemic be damned. And so it was a cool reunion show for us. And that's my brother. So all of the love vibes that we were exuding were because of our own personal bromance. And then
And then, yeah, and it was just fun to be in a room where people were there to take in some art and energy. It was awesome. And you, as the host, as part host of the space, yes, beautiful plant wall, but also setting the stage in the beginning with your remarks and making sure that there was fuel for the fire. We appreciate that. We appreciate that very much.
Oh my gosh, I wish I could be so cool, but I'm so selfish because I just wanted to see everybody. But thank you for giving me more positive attributes. I appreciate it. I do think it's interesting how words have been weaponized, because when I was a kiddo, you know, I spent most of my life in the library because I love to read. And I don't recall at that time, this was the 80s, there weren't really any books that I was forbidden to read. So I just got to go in there and just read what I wanted to my heart's content. And I do remember a little bit, Judy Blume's books at that time were a little controversial, but I read them and in junior high and high school, and I absolutely did not understand what the controversy was. And I think it's so interesting when adults get involved in kids' stories, because they're putting their own imprint, their own lens on that work. And the kids might read something like that and not even understand or comprehend what is so quote unquote wrong with it. And so the book banning thing has been really interesting to me, because I feel like when you ban something, it just means people want to read it even more.
You're right. And which is also like, yeah, I always felt like I said one day, if I'm ever cool enough or radical enough as a thinker, as a human, and as a person, if I'm ever revolutionary enough, I should be lucky enough to get any of my books or poems banned. If you're not writing at a level that frightens people, you're not actually changing anything. That's what I like to think. But you're right in that the war that's being waged on learning, the war that's being waged on exploration of ideas and ideology, as though you could somehow sanitize in the library is like trying to sanitize the ocean, right? It's like there's always going to be something that you haven't heard about or don't know about that someone's going to find to read or to share. And frankly, the banning, like you said, is not just making, it's for, you know, for a teenager. Yeah. As soon as you say, no, don't do that, they want to do that. So maybe there's this moment of, you know, intrigue that comes from the banning. But by and large, I think the strategy of the right, I'll say that, the political right, not necessarily just the ideological right, but the political right, is that they're less afraid or offended of the content in the books, because it's impossible to corral every single book. They're more afraid of teachers having the freedom to be that interpretive lens that you're talking about. Teachers being able to say, hey, this is the book, and something bad or good happens to this character in the book, and this character is of whatever heritage or background. And whether what has happened to them is right or wrong, that's the problem that anybody with a political agenda has, because it's okay when bad things happen to bad people or good things happen to good people. But when you don't like the message that's being sent to the reader of whatever age, that's actually when you have a problem with the content, because left to our own devices, we'll just read the book and we'll make meaning out of it as we will. But the instruction of the book is the real argument. Even if they want to be successful in the book banning, they're attacking the books instead of the people who are interpreting it. So I think it's a flawed strategy altogether.
Well, I would love to know, where did you grow up? Like, what did your childhood look like?
So I grew up in the Philadelphia area, just outside of... just in South Jersey, just outside of Philadelphia. And so that was, and I'm very proud of where I'm from. So I feel like as a Philly person, sometimes people think it's ego about our kind of outsized love and adoration for the place that we're from with all of its flaws. And I think that's an affect of being born in that area. You don't even have to like sports to really like cape for all the sports teams from Philly and to cape for all the amazing food that comes from the Philadelphia area, the proximity to the shore or the beach, the shore as we like to call it. I think that is a lot of the fuel for who I am today. Proximity to people, the lack of I mean, people in Philly are really working class and blue collar. People speak. Sometimes it's gruff, but you speak because it's a polite thing to do. And I just feel like a lot of that is who I am today, and frankly, who I'm raising my son to be. And so I love it, but I don't live there now because I live here, right? You know, and here has a different kind of charm. I think here is a great place to raise a child. Even though there's lots of people on the East Coast and there's a, you know, confluence of culture on the East Coast, I think the balance of cultures here is much more, I don't know, is much less forced and much more desired, and some of that's just an aspect of the history of this place. And so I think that that's good for him. He's getting a different kind of diversity by growing up here. But where I grew up, yeah, I grew up in a predominantly African-American suburb of Philly, and where my grandparents, my dad's parents lived. So I spent a lot of time in the city, as well as across the bridge where I grew up in South Jersey. And everything from my style, how I dress, to how I talk is influenced by that.
I was going to ask you as an aside. So, you know, I grew up outside of Chicago. And of course, you know, we have the hot dog, delicious Chicago dog. So what is the food that Philly's known for?
Oh, yeah. Well, first you got to start with the cheesesteak, the Philadelphia cheesesteak. It really is an institution. I don't eat cheesesteaks outside of the Philadelphia area because that is just glutton for disappointment, because it just can't possibly stack up. But we also do hoagies. We call them hoagies. I think heroes or subs out here to the civilians, but back there we call them hoagies. And even the convenience stores, Wawa, another institution that's to my heart. Best convenience store ever invented. Even the convenience store makes a mean hoagie, makes a mean sandwich, as we would call it out here. And so just the proliferation of good food is one of the other things that's just amazing about Philadelphia. Of course, with all the different cultures that have migrated there, any kind of food you want, any time of day or night, you could get it ordered. But specific to the region are things like our bagels. There's something about cooking a bagel at sea level that just makes it better than cooking a bagel at a mile high. There's something to be said about any kind of lunch meat, thanks to the European immigrants that have descended upon the Philadelphia area, and as well as water ice, or as we call it, water ice, because that's how you say water in Philadelphia area.
Yeah. Household. I'm like cheating because I know you did.
Yes, both my parents, late father, pastored a church in Atco, New Jersey. Shout out to the congregation at Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church. I grew up in a household where you went to church every Sunday. My grandfather was a deacon in a church in Philadelphia, Corinthians Baptist Church in Philadelphia. And once my father passed, my mom, who became a minister while he was still with us at church until fairly recently. So yeah, I grew up in the church.
Did you ever feel kind of, because of that family legacy, that it was a path that you wanted to follow?
I didn't know that I had a choice. I think in my household, it was very much, you go to God until you believe in God. And that, like, it's almost like a, if you go enough, you will one day have an epiphany, hopefully before you become an adult, but certainly after you become an adult, if you just stay in a church long enough, spiritually, you will arrive. And so it wasn't until I went away to college and, you know, I explored different churches in my same denomination, Southern Baptist, and then also churches that were not my denomination, and moving out here to New Mexico and checking out what's happening in Unitarian Church and checking out what's happening in the Buddhist temples. I kind of my eyes were opened to that. There's lots of ways to be in harmony with the universe, not just my kind of narrow interpretation of the Bible from my church and my upbringing. And so, yeah, like I did not know that there were other roads until well after I moved out of my parents' house. And it's been interesting as I kind of, as an adult, kind of make my own kind of religious practice, which parts of that I continue to use, which parts I've augmented with other ideologies and faiths that have come across my path, and ultimately how it all contributes to my current walk with God and my current understanding of the universe. So
I love that. That's such a beautiful answer. You know, you're such an interesting human being because you have this really lovely and dynamic creative side, but now you're going to law school. And, you know, if you talk to a lot of people, they're all about right brain, left brain, right? Like one side deals with logic and, you know, just rhetorical stuff and a straight way of being in the world. The other side is more creative and convoluted. But it sounds like you're utilizing both sides. So congratulations.
Yeah, I think I'm a Gemini, so maybe that's part of it, or I'm just crazy. I like to think that the right and left sides of the brain work in tandem, like the right and left sides of the heart, and it's oftentimes just a matter of you know, we all have a preference. I'm right-handed or left-handed, but you can learn how to shoot with your right hand. You can learn how to write with your left hand. You just got to give it, you know, time on task. Give it some attention.
That's really beautiful. Thank you. Because, you know, I have certainly talked to quite a few lawyers, and law school is no joke.
Oh, it's not. Oh, and I didn't think it was a joke. I also didn't know how serious it was, but I'm still here. And yeah, everybody says the first year is the hardest, and I just got through it. So we'll see. But I definitely, there's definitely a moment of reckoning where you have to be like, do I want to work this hard? Because if I do, I better start now.
So. Well, bless your heart, because I couldn't do it. So I appreciate your fortitude and your, I don't know, you just seem to have immense generosity of spirit, to be honest, because I presume, and maybe I'm assuming too much, but I presume you're going to law school. And have you picked a path in law school? Because I know there's many different kinds of law.
Yeah. You know, I think that what they always say is like, keep your options open. Don't go in too narrow-minded or too predetermined. Don't go in too decided on what part of the law you want to practice, because that's almost a recipe for failure, because you're eventually going to come across something that you didn't know you liked, and that could change, that could upend your whole plan, if you will. Now, I will say, I also have classmates who are like fresh out of undergrad, who are like on a no detour trajectory to becoming a New Mexico State Supreme Court justice, which is something that you can do when you go to law school in your 20s. Going to law school in your 40s, I don't quite have the same amount of runway to become a career, you know, justice, if you will. And so I went to law school to kind of augment the skill set that I had for the work that I already do with respect to policy, with respect to community building, and any other things I care about, right? You know, education, incarceration. So I felt like as an artist, I was able to make a difference in, you know, in my own way and in many of those spaces by working with discrete populations. And then eventually doing that long enough to get frustrated that nothing has really changed systemically, and knowing that the only way to do that is to either get duly elected by the people, which I have no interest in, mainly because of the fundraising part that it requires, or going to law school. And I was like, law school feels a lot easier. Instead of raising money, I'm spending money. Also to be at that table where hopefully solutions can be found, right? You know, and so that's all that to say, when I came into law school, I was definitely thinking about legislation more than litigation. But when we think of what lawyers are in a popular imagination, it's all law and order and courtroom stuff, which is litigation, less about legislation. And I remind people who like me love Hamilton, all our founding fathers were, you know, de facto attorneys. And that was legislation, not litigation. And so that's where we can dream up the world we want. We can dream up the country we want. We can dream up the policies and the futures we want. So I still think my future is there in legislation, with an emphasis on human rights law and constitutional law. But this summer I'm working for a firm where we litigate, and that's pretty intoxicating. It's a thing that's very interesting when you're in it. And then you're winning for individuals instead of winning for, you know, the community and society like you're doing when you're trying to create policy. You know, this is without feeding the stereotype of, you know, kid grows up, young kid of color, young Black kid grows up outside of a major metropolitan area and becomes a victim of gun violence. Like we know that story all too well. It's become somewhat of a stereotype, somewhat of a caricature of what it means to be a young Black person of color in this country. But that's where I've seen God move, right? I've seen God move in mysterious ways. I've seen God in my own life, and insert for those of us listening out there, insert whatever higher power you do or don't believe in into God. I'm gonna use the word God, because if my mom hears this, she's gonna be listening for that. But if you wanna say universe or whatever you like to say, say it. But that subatomic space between quarks and atoms, that thing, right? That energy that gives life, right? But I've experienced it personally. I was working for a summer at a call center job in Pennsauken, New Jersey, just outside of Cherry Hill. For people from that area, you know that Cherry Hill is like the very affluent side of the tracks, and then right across Route 70 is Pennsauken, which is where, you know, me and my friends would hang out. And it's proximal to Camden and Philadelphia, which are the much more urban populated areas, but in a generation just post exceptional white flight from Philadelphia, kind of in the late 60s, early 70s, a lot of Black families ended up in the burbs. First white families left, and then Black families followed them, and then white families moved back into the city. But that turnover of population that was happening in the late 70s, early 80s gave you that dynamic where you could have a Cherry Hill right next to a Pennsauken. After work there, I was getting my hair braided by one of my coworkers, African-American woman, at the time much older than me. For those of us who have Black hair, you know the process of getting your hair braided or cornrowed or locked or box braided is like a 3-hour process, whether you're doing it at a salon or in someone's home salon, which is the case for me. And you know, if you have a friend that can do it, you might save yourselves about $200 in the venture. And so she was hooking a brother up, and her boyfriend came home. And I have no idea what was going on in their relationship prior to him walking in and seeing a man maybe 10 or 15 years younger than his wife on the floor getting his hair braided. But whatever the state of their relationship was prior to that, it didn't involve me until that night. And he went to the back of she lived in a trailer park, and her roommate was there. And you heard tussling and what sounded like physical altercation. I immediately was like putting things together, like if that's the boyfriend and now they're fighting in the back, maybe I'm the reason that they're fighting. I'm just gonna go and get my things and get out of here and let you guys finish. He came out with a weapon and he pointed it at me and accused me of all kinds of things, including sleeping with his girlfriend, which was not the case. Said he was gonna kill me. And in that moment, something inside me said to say to him, no, you won't. He had already hit me at this point. I have 7-8 stitches in the back of my head to show for it. So I'm bleeding from my head, gun butt, pistol whip, whatever the kids call it in rap videos these days. But bleeding from my head. And he says he's gonna shoot me now, pointing it at me. And I'm in shock because I'm like, I'm bleeding from my head. I can see it now, see blood in my hands. And I said, no, you're not. And that wasn't me. I'm not that brave to tell this guy, no, you're not. Something else had to operate inside me to even, and that kind of startled him for a second. And then he like, you know, had the wherewithal to say, well, do you have any money on you? And I'm like, if I had more money, I would have been doing this in a salon and not in your girlfriend's living room. But no, I don't. You can't have that either. And then, of course, by then, sirens, the roommate had called the cops. Sirens are coming. He takes off. Fast forward, now I'm at the hospital. My mom gets the call and I'm at the hospital. Before my mom arrives to the hospital, the triage nurse sets me up in the room now, put something on the bleeding, and they're kind of asking me questions before the police get there to take a formal, like, get my statement. And she's leaving the room, a middle-aged white woman, and she turns around, her back, she's walking out, her back stiffens up, and she turns around, and her eyes are different, and her voice is different. And she walks back over to my bed, and she looks at me and says, "You weren't supposed to go tonight. God has a plan for you." And I'm like, huh? And I kind of look at her, and then she kind of looks at me, and she's staring at me, and she just blinks, walks out of that room. I never see this nurse ever again. My mom rushes in immediately after her. I'm trying to explain to her that the nurse just, like, that wasn't nurse talk. Before it was nurse talk. Now that was somebody else talking. And then shortly after that, the officers came in, and and there's no happy ending to that story. He had an unregistered weapon. He eventually did 5 years because in New Jersey, unregistered gun is automatic 5, federal 5. And I have no idea what either one of them are doing with their life anymore. But I ended up healing up and, going off to college. I think I was home for my first year from college that summer. So I went back to school and here I am talking to you today. Right. And it could have been very different. So that's how I've seen magic work in my life. And I wouldn't have known it was magic in that moment had that nurse not kind of, like, she really drove the point home. And I try to tell my son, like, God doesn't necessarily speak in burning bushes anymore, kid, but when you are being talked to by someone or something that is not of this realm, and it would behoove you to listen in those moments. And I think I did after that. So
I have to tell you, that is such an interesting story. And I got goosebumps while you were telling it, because I got interviewed for episode 100 by a very good friend, and I'd had two experiences in my life that completely were so disorienting and confusing for me. But then I discovered through a couple other people that there is a term called compassionate possession. And sometimes those spirits, God, those energies, sometimes they take people over and they relay a message that needs to be heard. And it sounds like that might be what happened with that nurse.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in a Black church tradition. I think they usually talk about it in churches of God and Christ, even though my church, CCU, Christ Care Unit Missionary Baptist Church, was not a Kojic church. It was just a Southern Baptist church in the Northeast. But in the Black kind of like evangelical tradition, those of you who've been to Black churches know it's nothing for someone to be speaking in tongues. For their body to be taken over by the Holy Ghost in a church service. I mean, I think out in the world, in the more popular culture, it would be like a Ouija board or a seance where somebody is like a spirit has inhabited someone. But I witnessed that. It happens.
It's really astonishing because I didn't believe in it until it happened to me. And I think you really have to experience it, because I think it's really interesting that you looked at the nurse and you could tell from her eyes that, like, she wasn't there anymore. Like something else was in there. And I've certainly had that experience a few times in my life. And it's a really powerful and fascinating experience. Also a little scary, but I'm so grateful that your whole story is so powerful. And I think, you're in this situation that I'm sure was beyond terrifying, yet, God showed up and gave you the strength and the bravery to get through it.
And very, I'm so very scary. Her whole posture changed, and I remember telling my mom, and we had a good laugh about it. My mom is a believer. She's a woman of faith, but we had a good laugh, because you got to have a sense of humor to be a person of faith, first of all. But if you don't have a sense of humor, you are not a person of faith. Let me just go there first. But we laugh about it, because she oftentimes is like, "I'm glad you got that message." And she was like, "And it only took someone giving you 7 stitches in your head for you to get it, because you hard headed. But you got the message." And she's also like, "But low key though, you also kind of had a mild concussion, so maybe you were just seeing things." But whatever it was,
it mattered and it changed me.
Those moments change us forever. I'm going to go with that it wasn't the concussion, that it actually happened. So
I mean, you can't tell me any different.
Yeah.
You can't tell me any different.
Was I lying when I said that Hakeem is just this unbelievable human who does everything? I hope that our conversation allowed you to kind of understand just why I was so captivated by Hakeem and by the work he's doing in the world. To see more, or to read more, or to listen more to this human being's incredible creative mind and all of his projects, I'm going to have a link to his YouTube channel on the Treasures page of the website, and then a link to his website under the episode show notes. Please do yourself the biggest favor and jump into Hakeem's world and all the beauty that he's created. I'd also love to take this time to ask anyone who's listened, please consider writing a review or leaving a rating for the podcast. Those ratings and reviews help other people find us, and it's all part of the hustle of getting this podcast out into the world. I'm so very close to 3 years of doing this podcast, and it's so exciting. I had no idea I would even do 20 episodes, and now here we are at episode 125. Who knew? Thank you so much for listening, and I need to thank Hakeem for being such a gracious and intelligent guest. And then I need to thank the creators of the music used for this episode. Of course, Hakeem and his gorgeous poem at the beginning of the episode, but also Sasha End, Taiga Sound Productions, and Chilled Music. For complete attributions, please see the Bite Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. On the website, you'll find links to books, music, art, and of course, Hakeem's incredible work, both under the episode's show notes and on the Treasures page of the website. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Hakeem. Channel whatever you can in your body, your mind, your heart. What can you do in this world to make it a more beautiful place, a more just place for those who don't have the same advantages that you do? Find out whatever that is, whether it's reciting poetry at your local cafe or volunteering at a food bank. What can you do to bring beauty to others? Think about it, cogitate a little bit, and then put your plan in action. See you next week for the very next groovy episode, episode 126. And until then, I hope you have a week filled with magic and miracles and super cool strangers who ultimately become your friends.